History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't need to go untold. As long as somebody, and maybe that's you, is willing to take a little initiative and then employ the patience to listen as long buried memories return to the surface again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I expect that to be the case again today in Prunedale, California, with 95-year-old Joe Pintacura. We're going to hear how Joe and his three older brothers all served in the Navy during World War II, but let's start off with the early years growing up in Chicago, Illinois.
I come from a big family. I had three older brothers and two older sisters. I was the last one on the list. So everything that they liked, I wound up liking. My brothers liked baseball, swimming, football, and so I ended up whining just like them. And when they went into the Navy, they all went into the Navy, so I had to go in the Navy too.
And before that, you know, I've heard a lot of stories from people your age and older who lived through the Great Depression and how different those days were. How did you and your family experience the Great Depression?
Well, I know my parents had a hard time. My older brother went into the Conservation Corps in order to, you know, save one more mouth to feed at home. They were on relief. I can remember the relief truck coming and dropping off a great big box of beans and flour and sometimes, you know, fresh fruit. And it was always like, what did we get, you know, that type of excitement. And I know their house was almost foreclosed on because some of the furniture was repossessed. And they really had a tough time. I was home by myself when the furniture guys came, and I let them in. I was little. And they started to take furniture out, and just happened my mom came about that time and stopped them. And then she also, I know they made a deal with the banks to pay off the house over. You know, they changed the payments and stuff. They really had a tough time. My brother Sam at the time, he was the next one down from my brother Tony. He had a job like a paper route, that type of thing. My sisters, my oldest one, I didn't know her as well at the time because she got married to get out of the household. But as far as I was concerned, I was the baby. There was no suffering for me. Everybody took care of me. Yeah, the depression didn't hurt me one bit.
Because that does sound like a lot of mouths to feed, but you guys always had enough to eat?
Yes, always had enough to eat. And the strangest meals, you know, like warm milk with bread in it, and I loved it. Sometimes just fruit, whenever we got a hold of it. I didn't know any different. It was just great. They were a wonderful family. I was spoiled so rotten that sometimes they got angry at me for wanting this and wanting that, you know. So, yeah, it was a great life. The depression was tough on them, but easy on me.
And how did you get along with all those siblings?
You know, we're really a tight family. There wasn't a Sunday that went by that we weren't all together. And even when my sisters started getting married and their husbands wound up in our home. In fact, when I was dating my sweetheart, Shirley, I said, we just have to go to my house every Sunday. It's a must. We don't have any choice.
What would the typical meal be on a Sunday there?
Oh, I've always had pasta of some kind and ravioli, meatloaf, and lots of it. And my mother used to always, when she made the gravy or the pasta sauce, she used to make us keep separate so that we could dip homemade bread in it. And it was just great, yeah.
You're making me hungry, Joe. And what about, you know, to be a boy in those years, what kinds of things kept you busy outside the house? What were you up to?
Well, until I started finding friends through school, you know, the early grades, there was not much, but when they started getting into 7th and 8th grade, you know, then I start palling around with a number of guys from the area neighborhood. And we used to hang out at the school playground. You know, Chicago, we have the heavy, hard winters. All the school grounds where they play baseball, they flood that. So it freezes. And then we ice skate there. And so between playing ball and ice skating, and there was always lots of activities. And my buddies were like I was when December 7th hit. They were just like, what, a war? You know, that was just, couldn't believe it.
Well, and before I get into that with you, I'm interested too, because I think, did you tell me you were really close to Wrigley Field where you grew up?
Yeah, really close. And I used to get free passes for the ball game from those players. And there was Dizzy Dean, and they were all a ton of the well-known ones in those days. And I used to think nothing of it, meeting them, shaking hands, going to games. And they used to practice a couple of blocks away from Wrigley Field at an elementary school. And, of course, everybody was there watching them play. And any of the kids would chase foul balls because they would knock them out of the elementary school park all the time. It was great. Chicago Cubs were, that was my hero team, you know.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you were a little bit on the young side, but this is still the era, too, where Al Capone kind of ruled Chicago, right?
Yeah, I remember being afraid because I heard stories like he drove down the street with his machine gun sticking out the car door windows and shooting houses as they went by. And I was saying, don't come down my street. Please don't come down my street. Yeah, there was a lot of that gangster stuff. And my parents always said, whatever you do, don't go down on the south side. Always stay on the north side of Chicago, because that's where all the bad guys are, on the south side. And that was my little savior part of it. I figured he's not going to drive down Racine Avenue, where I lived. And he's going to be shooting those people out on the south side.
Do you remember, Joe, having a dream when you were a boy, some hope or ambition of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with myself, with my life?
I had all kinds of those ambitions. You know, I was going to be a pilot. I was going to be a ship captain. Whatever I saw in the movies, and I was liked it, I wanted to be. And John Wayne, we played cowboys. I wanted to go out west and become a cowboy. Yep, I had all those dreams. Never had anything pertinent, you know, like say, that's what I really want to be. Like my brother Roy, he wanted to be an artist, and he pursued that. He turned out to be a terrific artist. And eventually got his own business in commercial art. Yep, those. My oldest brother was a mechanic, but I didn't have any desire to be a mechanic because every time I tried to do something, the wrench would hit my hand. Or the first time I tried to change the tire, I was so angry because I couldn't do it. I had to get some help.
And had your parents both come to America from Italy?
Yes, both came from Sicily. My dad came first because he had some brothers, my uncles, and that were already here in Chicago. So they kind of sponsored him so he could get here. And then he got my mom and my oldest sister. She was born in Italy too. They always had us, the kids, to try to speak English in the house so that they would learn. And that's how they got to be pretty smart too.
Could you understand Italian too?
At that time, I was really good at understanding Italian. In fact, I used to speak it. Now I hardly speak it. And I still understand quite a bit of it. I came home speaking English so to make them happy. And I wanted to learn English too, because when I was little, all I did was speak Italian.
Did your family encounter any kind of prejudice or bias, discrimination against Italian Americans?
No, not that I know of. And I never heard my brothers or sisters saying, you know, there's a problem of some kind. I think we always felt comfortable living on the north side of Chicago. My father had a job at Florshine Shoe Company, so that, you know, it's pretty America. My sister Jane could do hair dressing, you know, and so people would come to the house and she would do their hair for them. Hairdresser.
Did she cut yours too?
Yeah. Everybody was wonderful. My brothers and my sisters, the only arguments we had is when she was sweeping or something and I'd walk in and right across it, you know, can't you see I'm sweeping? Can't you tell I'm sweeping? And you walk right across it. Those type of things.
I know a lot of siblings are nodding their heads. They've had the same scenario. And you mentioned already December 7th, 1941. But if I'm doing the math, you would have been a 15-year-old when that happened. What do you remember about that day?
I remember I was in the house. And there was people yelling outside. It was like Sunday morning. And people in the streets were yelling at them. Sometimes, you know, when they have newspapers, they'll have extra. They'll be selling them, yelling extra. But this was people across the street. They had their windows open, and they were yelling out, we're at war, we're at war. So I went out on our front porch. I couldn't hardly grasp it. So what I did is I headed over to my buddies that lived about five blocks away. And when I got over there, it was the same scenario. People were yelling. My buddies were all outside, and we were trying to get more information. And that's when I first heard about Pearl Harbor, and I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. It was crazy. Then everything was hectic from that time on. Everybody who couldn't join wanted to join. Everybody who could join actually did go join. Yeah, it was exciting for a number of days there. And then when we heard, well, you can see newsreels in the movie theaters, you know, we went to the theaters to see what we could see. And the newspapers had, you know, pictures of Pearl Harbor. Then we got to hear, I think it was the next day or shortly after, a speech over the radio by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and talked about this day will go down in infamy. It made it sound like there was a dirty, low-handed, terrible thing to do to us, because they had some ambassadors in Washington at the time that were representing goodwill. And here, knowing that they're going to bomb, at the same time talking sweet talk, yeah, everybody was angry. You know, and the other thing that turned out to be a wrong move that really bothered us later when we start to wake up is when they put all these innocent Japanese, and they didn't call them concentration camps. They just gathered them up and putting them in Utah and all those faraway places from the coast. And then we found out many of their sons went into service, fought for America. Many of the parents kept repeating over and over again, hey, we're on your side. We'll do whatever you want. And it's just a shame, I guess, in the panic, many things can go wrong, and they did.
Yeah, where you live now here in Prunedale, California, that happened to a lot of Japanese Americans around this area. And I've actually interviewed Italian Americans from this area, too, who were pulled in off the coastline because of the concern of that loyalty with Italy being on Germany's side in the war. So you said all four of you Pinacura boys went in the Navy. So who was first? Who was the first one in?
My oldest brother, Tony, was the first one to go in. It was either that or he got drafted, and he didn't want to go in the Army. Fortunately for him, he got stationed in the States. He never did go overseas. And then when my brother Sam was going to be drafted, he joined the Navy too. And he wound up below the equator in the New Hebrides Islands. But he was a mechanic also, and he could work on a lot of the airplanes that would go down there for repairs and stuff. Then my brother Roy, I'm not sure whether it had anything to do with the draft in his case. I think because my two older brothers, then he wanted to go in the Navy too. And I kind of thought, well, you know, I'm not going to break tradition. I'll go in the Navy too. But my mom and dad, who really didn't want me to go in because I was the last one, have to thank my sweetheart Shirley, because I was going to go in the minute I turned 18, which would have been July 19. And because I fell in love with this sweetheart, I didn't want to leave her. So I was fighting the battle of should I enlist now or wait, and I dragged that out until February of 1944. 43 is when I met her, and then February of 44, I went in. So I was home 6 months longer. And in any case, my parents were really happy with her keeping me home.
Well, we've got to hear the story of how you met, because you two would spend the rest of your lives together. So what were the circumstances of your meeting Shirley, and what do you remember about that first impression she made on you?
I had a job at a factory that was not too far from our house. It was in the summertime. They only had students come in the summertime, young people. And we used to do what's a little piecework. And the more you did, the more money you would make. In those days, if you were on an hourly pay, it would be like 40 cents an hour. But anyhow, I had been there one summer, and then the following summer I went back, and when I went back, there she was applying for the job. And I was standing in line right near her, and I says, hey, I can give you some pointers because I worked there last year. So I told her what I thought, and I told her the guy she's going to talk to is a really great guy, and I thought I did a heck of a good job. And they did hire her. So the next day, when she came to work, at the lunch break, I went, because they put her in a different floor, so I didn't see her. But she went out for lunch because it was hot in Chicago. Everybody goes outside to eat. So I see her sitting on a railing, and I run over there, and I sit next to her, and I says, so I got you the job, huh? And she says, you know what? You're conceited. And I said, well, what does that mean? She says, you know, you think a lot about yourself. You're bragging. And, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you could just go get lost. And I says, wait a minute. I said, I'm really a nice guy. I really am. Let me prove it to you. She says, no, just go sit over somewhere else. So I did. I had to. But then when she was going back in, I opened the door for her. And then she's going out, I run down and opened the door for her. And pretty soon she let me sit with her. And Then one day I said, how about going to the movies? She said, yeah. And that was it. From that time on, we just stuck together like glue. It was great.
So I guess, you know, there's one question that you can't really answer, but I'm sure you have an opinion about or an idea. So if you hadn't met Shirley and you had gotten your parents to sign for you and gone in 43 like you thought, what do you think would have happened to you? How different would your life have been?
Oh, my. I can't even imagine. When she came into my life, it was just two. We were just two. There was no more one. I don't know what I would have done. In fact, after I joined, I was kicking myself. I said, now you can't see her. And, you know, I got in boot camp and I'm with all these guys, and that just made me angry. That I blamed myself. And she was such a sweetheart. When I got on the train, after I got out of Great Lakes training station, I told her we're all going on the train to South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina. And I'll be darned if she wasn't at that train station. Yeah, we got the hug and kiss. Goodbye. She was wonderful. And always was her whole life.
I imagine you must have gotten a few letters from her aboard ship, too.
Oh, my God, yeah. She wrote every day. And I tried to answer everyone, too. And I'm not sure they all got home. And I'm not sure all of hers got to me, because we were at a lot of different places, and we didn't have a lot of mail calls sometimes. And when we did, boy, it was a great day. And sometimes I'd get letters that were... She sent after, in other words, the first letters hadn't reached me yet, but the second ones did. And it would be seesaw between letters. And then she said all my letters came back to her all cut up from the censors. I don't know what I was saying, but I don't think I was letting out any secrets. That's what they did. They read all of our letters before they went out to back home.
Yeah, take a razor blade to them. Did you have an idea before you were assigned? Did you have an idea of what kind of ship you were hoping to end up on?
No, I just followed whatever he sent me.
As it turns out, he would be sent into the teeth of a typhoon, an infamously destructive typhoon. We'll hear about that and other World War II Navy experiences with 95-year-old Joe Pinacura of Prunedale, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.